This is Richard Tarnas, April 12, 2013. Is modern humanity undergoing a rite of passage?
Over the course of the past year, I've had the pleasure of working with Dr. Randy Morris in a collaborative effort to bring the work of Richard Tarnas here to Seattle. Randy Morris is with Antioch University in Seattle and is a core member. He supervises the Spiritual Studies program and teaches classes on depth psychology, the history of ideas, and liberal arts. We thank Randy and Antioch's role in co-sponsoring this event. And so Richard Tarnas, our speaker tonight, our guest, is a professor of psychology and cultural history at California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, where he founded the graduate program in philosophy, cosmology, and consciousness. He lectures on archetypal studies and depth psychology at Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara. He is the author of Passion of the Western Mind, which, by the way, we've got these copies, and it's a fabulous book. It's a history of the Western world view from ancient Greek to postmodern that became both a bestseller and a required text in many universities. Cosmos and Psyche, Intimations of a New World View, Dr. Richard Tarnas.
Thank you very much, Anne, for that welcoming introduction. Also for your confidence that this is going to be an engaging lecture tonight. And I want to thank both Anne as well as Randy. A lot of effort goes into hosting guest speakers from out of town, putting on any kind of public lectures, symposia, conferences. A lot of invisible work goes into it, and many people contribute to it, Randy and Anne being especially prominent in this way, and I know there's others, you know, Brian and Tom was played a role. So thank you all for all that you've done. I want to address the issue of our moment in history that we find ourselves in today, and I want to try to understand it in a larger context to discern its underlying archetypal dynamics, to try to put our finger on the pulse of those deeper stirrings in the collective psyche that are at work today. We live in an extraordinary age of the world, as I don't have to tell you. We all sense the gravity of our time, the urgency. Events of such great magnitude are taking place in our age. Not only of great magnitude, but of great consequences that we can only intuit in the vaguest way what are the longer-term implications. I'm thinking of events of such significance and power as the tremendous mass extinction of species, the extreme weather that is even being reported in the mainstream press, which is often neglectful of otherwise extremely important events that are taking place for our not only the human community but the Earth community. The Arab Spring, the melting polar ice caps, the events such as the tsunami, earthquake, nuclear disaster that happened in Japan, which is a kind of in microcosm, the kind of like the trifecta of catastrophes that were all interlinked and somehow captured the drama of what a precarious moment we are in, and in which human activity is playing such a complex interlocking role with tectonic activity and climatic events and larger geological, biological dramas that we, like a sorcerer's apprentice, have catalyzed and are in unpredictable ways interplaying with. We also see every day in the news the intensified clash of opposing forces and entrenched power and powerful forces of change at the same time, diametrically engaged. Old structures are collapsing in our time. Many sense that, to put it in a kind of Tolkien-like way, that an old age of the world is passing in our time. Jung foresaw this, as we many of us know, in his later 70s and 80s, he came into more and more of a kind of prophetic intuitive sensibility. And in one of his later works, and you know that amazing last 10 to 12 years of his life when he just, in his 70s and 80s, was just cooking, one essay after another from basically what On the Nature of the Psyche, which is his overall kind of systematic summary of his psychology and metapsychology from the late 40s, but then one after another from during the 1950s, where he does Answer to Job, perhaps his most powerfully prophetic work, also his major work of religious understanding, and where he even predicts 10 years before it happens, the women's movement and the transformation in the collective psyche of the relative dynamics of feminine and masculine energies. And he writes Synchronicity, an acausal connecting principle, very significant intervention in our understanding of causality, of, I mean, he labored so strongly on behalf of bringing a different understanding of how meaningfully correlated events, powerfully coincidental, meaningful events, for correlating inner and outer states with such commonality of archetypal patterning that one cannot but recognize that something more is going on than purely mechanistic reductionism in explaining how these meaningful coincidences inform our lives. And he wrote Ion and Mysterium Conjunctionis and Memories, Dreams, Reflections, one of the more amazing autobiographical experiments that anyone's written. All this in his later 70s and 80s. I mean, one gives one hope when feels that if you actually look, I'm giving a tribute for James Hillman next month in New York. And if you look at people like Hillman, who was just so creative and acute right up in his perceptions and his articulation, understanding, right up to age 85, same age actually as Jung was when Jung died. Freud himself, age 83, writing brilliantly that brief outline of psychoanalysis that in about 70 pages just condenses his whole life work. Joseph Campbell, all those interviews that he did with Moyers, he's He's 83 years old then. They're released posthumously because they just before he died, but he's just like, that is, the interviews happened just in that last year of his life, and then he passes away, and then the world, on a much larger scale than before he died, was aware of this treasure that he came back from his hero's journey with, about the mythic imagination and what it signifies for the spiritual adventure of our time. Marion Woodman, Marie-Louise von Franz, all of these figures were not just lucid, but profoundly insightful and creative into their 80s. It makes one think depth psychology may have a little something extra of help for us besides enriching our the middle years of our lives, but perhaps not only giving meaning to the later years of our lives, which certainly Jung had in mind, but perhaps even giving us more years of life, of meaning. So he, this is in 1956, Jung writes a monograph, an essay called The Undiscovered Self, where he gives his sense of the state of the world at that point. And in it, he gives that famous passage about our moment being representing a kairos. I'll just remind you of that passage. This is The Undiscovered Self, C.G. Jung, chapter 10, verses 5 to 15. That's a joke. Sometimes when I'm giving lectures at Jungian organizations, it's in chapels and sanctuaries and churches, and you really get the sense of the Saint C.G. Jung and his apostles, etc. A mood of universal destruction and renewal has set its mark on our age. This mood makes itself felt everywhere, politically, socially, and philosophically. We are living in what the Greeks called the kairos, the right moment for a metamorphosis of the gods, of the fundamental principles and symbols. This peculiarity of our time, which is not of our conscious choosing, is the expression of the unconscious human within us who is changing. Coming generations will have to take account of this momentous transformation if humanity is not to destroy itself through the might of its own technology and science. So much is at stake, and so much depends on the psychological constitution of the modern human. Here he captures the whole, and Jung was always tuned into the mythos, the mystery of the death, rebirth mystery, and of birth and death. And here he sees it at work in history. And we look at our own time, and here it is 50 years later. If anything, everything that he said is even more dramatically in evidence. And it takes a certain spiritual fortitude to look at what's happening to our Earth community with open eyes and an open heart, and to keep one's eyes and heart open as one is taking in the drama. We sense that something is struggling to be born, and we also see that something is clearly dying. And at times, the dying can be far more apparent. It takes a certain equilibrium to not fall into an apocalypse complex, we might call it, where one really does get kind of possessed by a dark vision. You see it erupting every once in a while with, like, just, say, just before we moved into the new millennium with the Y2K anxiety that kind of collectively possessed many people who saw the possibilities of a collapse of civilization with the electronic grids, the computers all lined up with the wrong dating because it hadn't been programmed correctly to register the movement to a new millennium after 1999, and all the work that the engineers did. James Hillman had a very funny thing to say about that. I heard him speak in 1999 as we were approaching that moment at a Santa Barbara lecture, and he talked about how Y2K, we have built right into the Christian calendar the apocalyptic mentality. See how he manages to get a couple of sharp shots off right away at some of his favorite enemies. But then, as we all remember, December 31st, 1999 turns into January 1st, 2000. The world didn't come to an end, nor did the civilization even seem to go through any kind of a even minor electronic glitch and computer meltdown, and instead it was experienced both with a sigh of relief, a certain celebratory quality across the world, and perhaps a certain sense of triumph that the preparations that the engineering mentality and the computer programmers and modern rationality had basically met the challenge and kept apocalypse at bay. And James Hillman, the next time that he gave a major lecture in 2000 at the big Threshold Conference in the University of California, Santa Barbara, of archetypal psychologists, in the first paragraph of his talk, and he mentioned what had just happened, that sigh of relief, that sense of kind of can-do triumph that was widespread. And Hillman characteristically said, "Can we not snatch some defeat out of this victory?" That's James in a nutshell, like always trying to recognize the manic inflation and bring about the redemptive shadow. Bring about a recognition of the opposite side that's being held back in the manic American mentality is a profound grieving, a depression that won't be faced, etc. So he's managing in one fell swoop to kind of get back at Christianity, at modern scientism, at the can-do American optimistic spirit, all of his bête noire antagonists. But getting back to this danger of the apocalypse complex, the Jewish New York philosopher Woody Allen put his finger on this with characteristic Schopenhauerian precision in that famous speech to the graduates that he gave a few years ago, where he said, "More than at any other time in history, mankind faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness. The other path, to total extinction. Let us pray we have the wisdom to choose correctly." I speak, by the way, this is a little bit more from Woody Allen. "I speak, by the way, not with any sense of futility, but with a panicky conviction of the absolute meaninglessness of existence, which could easily be misinterpreted as pessimism." It is not. It is merely a healthy concern for the predicament of modern man. And then he finishes, "Modern man is here defined as any person born after Nietzsche's edict that God is dead. But before the hit recording, I want to hold your hand." Okay. So now, you can see how Professor Allen has marvelously juxtaposed several crucial motifs that actually we might have a bit to say about tonight in playing a role in our moment in history, because he is basically, in one paragraph, connected on the one hand, that's the sense of existential despair and hopelessness, with, on the other hand, biological extinction, or the catastrophic state of the global biosphere, to put it in more up-to-date terms. And then he's also brought up the sense of how in the background, the state of alienation of living in a disenchanted cosmos, which is what, when Nietzsche says God is dead, Nietzsche is referring to that destruction of the spiritual and metaphysical ground of the kind of metastructure that had held in place our civilization and its moral orientation for thousands of years, and that's the modern mind had basically devastated that. It had erased the horizon of meaning within which humanity existed. And then he finally, and I'm sure this is an entirely unconscious juxtaposition, he said, he talks about this is just merely the predicament of modern man. And in so doing, he highlights that masculine symbolization of the larger human being, larger human sensibility, project, consciousness, with the privileging of the masculine, which we can see in a certain crucial respect has played a critical role in shaping our world and our worldview, with that tremendous focus on the differentiation out of the matrix of being and the assertion of autonomy and individualism and the kind of radical differentiation of the part out of the whole, of man from nature, of mind from body and our emotional, somatic, imaginative ground. And in many ways, this differentiation became a kind of dissociation that has played a critical role in the constellating of our very problematic moment. So we could bring up something else, though, that Nietzsche said, which those of you who have read Passion of the Western Mind, in the very beginning, as my epigraph, that is the quote that I use from, in this case, Friedrich Nietzsche, to begin the whole book, I quote his poetic sentence from Thus Spoke Zarathustra, where he said, "The world is deep, deeper than day can comprehend." The world is deep, deeper than day can comprehend. You could say that the day is ruled by the sun. The day is the solar logos light of reason, the conscious egoic awake consciousness, the light of common day, to use Wordsworth's term, the enlightenment of the modern era. The night is the other side of the coin. The world is deep, deeper than day can comprehend, because the world is made of day and night. It's both sun and moon. The moon is the ruler of the night, of the night sky. The moon brings a different that luminary, that other side of being, is the great metaphor for a different kind of sensibility than that solar, monotheistic, Cartesian, egoic consciousness, the heroic solar ego that has the one light that's so bright that when it shines, you see clarified and differentiated everything so vividly. But when night comes, you see, even with the moon, you see also many lights, not just that one. You also see into the depths of space. In some sense, you get a glimpse of the whole into deep space compared to the day, where it's a much more limited but brilliantly illuminated and differentiated consciousness that you have. But the night is the night of mystery, as the day is of clarity. The night has a different relationship between shadow and light, between the many and the one. Many truths, many lights are possible. And in some sense, it's the great symbol of the whole. It's what, you know, in Jung's, in kind of classical Jungian symbolism, as well as in astrology, sometimes the sun is called the conscious self and the moon is the unconscious. But that's not quite right. The sun is the symbol of a certain kind of consciousness, as I've been describing it, while the moon is the symbol of another. It is the symbol of what that solar consciousness and what a particular kind of solar consciousness in our time is unconscious of. It's not unconscious in, it's not the unconscious in some reified way in itself. It's what the solar consciousness tends to be unconscious of. Our relational, our intuitive, our somatic, our emotional ground, which indeed we are often unconscious of. And we need to have a relationship between the conscious and the unconscious in order to establish a dialogue to a deeper, more expanded consciousness. Depth psychology, the depth dimension is what it gives us. Depth of vision comes from the stereoscopic having both eyes. I was reading the other day an ancient Egyptian prayer about the sun and the moon are the two eyes of the cosmic deity. And we need both solar and lunar to see the part and the whole, the day and the night, the luminous, awake, rational, individual consciousness in relationship to that larger mystery of being that the depth carries. Now, in the modern era, depth psychology was a central, crucial element of the great intellectual, spiritual compensation to the one-sided, heroic, solar consciousness that first became dominant in the modern era, particularly in the European Enlightenment. And depth psychology of this past century, I mean, basically arising the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, can be seen as this vast compensatory reaction to that one-sided consciousness. And Freud and Jung and William James in America, but also Anna Oh, who was actually her real name. Anna Oh was what was the name that was used by Breuer and Freud when they wrote about her, and she played such a role as a patient in giving birth to how the depth psychology orientation unfolded. Her real name was Bertha von Pappenheim. And also Sabina Spielrein and Tony Wolf and Emma Jung and the many women in Zurich and in Vienna who came to Freud and Jung and the psychoanalysts and analytical psychologists, and basically those men and women together co-created the depth psychology revolution. It wasn't, each needed the other, each provided a necessary part of this co-created transformation of consciousness that depth psychology represents. The sociologist George Homans, once wrote in a book called Jung in Context, he said the 20th century was the psychological century. And I think in many ways that's quite accurate. I mean, you could also say it's the cosmological century. You could say it's the anthropological century, and those are accurate too. But certainly the depth psychological perspective, which is beginning a little over a century ago, is absolutely crucial. It plays three big roles that I just headline here. One is you can see it as essentially a kind of an outgrowth of the history that preceded it. In a way, it's a necessary outgrowth. It's a necessity. It's the great, I think Jung put it, as the great reassertion of the psychic depths that had been suppressed by the rationalist enlightenment. That it, those depths that had been carried previously by religion and by myth. Secondly, depth psychology in relationship to history allows us to see that history in a new light. It illuminates that history. It gives us a tool, an instrument, a lens with which we can see more deeply into what's happening in the great historical evolution of humanity and of our time. And thirdly, depth psychology represents it itself is, having emerged, it becomes a player in that history. It is itself an intervention. Now, you notice that I'm saying a lot about history. Daniel Boorstein, the Librarian of Congress at one time and a major historian, he once said, trying to create the future without knowing the past is like trying to plant cut flowers. That's a very Jungian statement, isn't it? I mean, Jung could have said that. He had such a sense that trying to live as a human being into your future without having a sense of the extraordinary historical depths that we all carry in us, in our the archetypal unconscious, would be like trying to plant cut flowers. He had such a sense for we needed to be rooted in the soil. We need to have our rootedness. His whole sense of individuation is quite a different one from the usual modern definition of individuation. Individuation, if you just first look it up in the dictionary, would more talk about essentially differentiation out of the whole, out of the becoming of the individual, separate from the collective, separate from the whole. Well, yes, that's true, but Jung said something more than that. It wasn't simply the separation. It wasn't simply the differentiation. If you have that, you have modern man in search of his soul, as one of his titles put it. You have an egoic self cut off from its ground, from its roots, from its rhizome. Instead, he had a recognition that the true individuation requires a reconnection with the ground of being, with one's roots, with the deep archetypal sources of meaning and purpose that can only be recovered after one has done a journey, after one has gone down, has descended, has gone into the deep unconscious, has risked one's sanity, the Red Book, which all of us, before it came out for everybody to see in 2009, we all already had a sense for what he'd been through. This vivified it, but it here it's just clear the descent that he took, and he came back from his profound inner journey with many gifts for us, many treasures that he leaves us with. And these gifts were all the more substantive because he was a scientist, he was a physician, he was a scholar, and so he held greater authority in an age that valorized those figures, an age whose intellectual faith has centered itself to a great extent in science, the great transition from religion to science as holding the center of gravity for the worldview that took place in the course of the Renaissance through the scientific revolution and enlightenment. That 150-200 year period brought about a dramatic transformation of our worldview and, in many ways, modern humanity, modern civilization, the modern mind, constellated a new center of gravity, which science in particular held. And Jung assimilated that, and he also knew that there was, as William James would put it, something more. And he held that tension of opposites powerfully, held it. Let me say something about that tension of opposites while I think of it from a letter that he wrote. I don't know how many of you know this particular letter that he wrote to Olga Frobe-Kapteyn, who was the woman who organized the Arinos conferences in Lago Maggiore in Ascona, Switzerland. And he went there every year with all these great scholars, like the list is a kind of who's who, Neumann and Buber and Tillich and Eliade, and later years Corbin. Hillman became a great significant figure there. Joseph Campbell, of course. Campbell edited several volumes from that series. And Olga Kapteyn Frobe wrote Jung one day in 1945, August of 1945. So that means Jung would have been 70 years old. This is the year. This is the month that World War II came to an end, catastrophically. In Japan. So, and Jung had been through his near-death experience by then, and he'd gone through that transformation where he just felt from then on he needed to speak directly to the world about what he felt to be true, knew to be true, no longer so hidden from or concealed behind the persona of what would be appropriate for the public or the other, his professional colleagues, but instead straight from some greater depth. And in this letter, which I know I have with me, if it will just here, jump out at me, thank you. A lot of times Jung wrote letters with greater directness of kind of an eloquence would come in, because he's not at all thinking about how it's going to be read by many people. It's just him to this one other person. So she has written him about the problem that she is experiencing of being caught between career demands and family demands. A problem none of us, I'm sure, can relate to, but it's, if you can use an act of the imagination. Sort of, we can enter into that problem. And Jung answers it in a very characteristic way by beginning with that sense of kind of almost absolute determinism that he could get into. And then he keeps going, though, with it in a marvelous way. He says, "Dear Frau Frobe, there can be no resolution, only patient endurance of the opposites, which ultimately spring from your own nature. You yourself are a conflict that rages in itself and against itself. In order to melt its incompatible substances, the male and the female, in the fire of suffering, and thus create that fixed and unalterable form which is the goal of life. Everyone goes through this mill, consciously or unconsciously, voluntarily or forcibly. We are crucified between the opposites and delivered up to the torture until the reconciling third takes shape. Do not doubt," and here's the extraordinary kind of climax of the letter, "do not doubt the rightness of the two sides within you, and let whatever may happen, happen. The apparently unendurable conflict is proof of the rightness of your life. A life without inner contradiction is either only half a life, or else a life in the beyond, which is destined only for angels. But God loves human beings more than the angels. With kindest regards, yours sincerely, C.G. He was such a trickster. You know, I don't know if you've seen that BBC interview where he's talking about, he's about 83 or something at that point, and he's talking about his grandchildren hiding his glasses and hiding his things. And you can see he's totally delighted. There's a twinkle in his eye, and he's totally delighting in their tricking him as the old grandfather. And you can see how I admire Freud very much, as I admire Jung in different ways. And they both had their shadow. Freud, you can see that Jung somehow went through a depth of transformation that allowed him to come back with a kind of joy of life, an engagement with the adventure of life that lasted right up to the end. For all his historical anxieties for the future of humanity, he also had that twinkle in his eye. He had that delight. I think it has something to do with the depth of the initiatory transformation that he went through. You also see it in, I mean, he was working with psychotics in those early years that shaped his work so much, while Freud was working with neurotics more. And the kind of therapeutic orientation, I think, that Freud particularly practiced and kept restrained things to can only get so far. And I think Jung opened up more possibilities. It allows a greater depth. Not that that's the last word. But you see, we know the value of things by the fruit. And I think we can see that value at work even in that kind of trickster quality. That delight that he carries in the young, the unexpected. Now, Jung left these, maybe I'll just give a quick suggestion of these kind of, I mean, all of you in this room have such a familiarity with Jung, all I'll need to do is just give a headline, but I think it's helpful for us to kind of recount what these particular gifts were that Jung left us with. And I'm saying this as I'm not a Jungian analyst. I'm deeply influenced by Jung. I've studied Jung and Jungian's thought and post-Jungian's quite a bit. I'm always seeking to understand Jung and depth psychology in a larger context at the same time as trying to understand that larger context through depth psychology. And some of the things that I noticed that we could say, standing kind of far back from the Jungian phenomenon, is we can see, first of all, one of the gifts is he gave the recognition that life was a spiritually meaningful journey of transformation, later life as well as early and middle life. He brought soul and spirit into modern psychology. He saw the psychological journey as really a journey of initiation. And therefore, he had a sense of the importance of aging and maturation and of death and of rebirth. So that's one thing, bringing that soul and spirit, seeing life as a meaningful spiritual journey of transformation. Another was that he saw the individual journey, our individual lives and our individual psyches, as embedded in and deeply interconnected with with the life and soul of the collective, of the depths of history collectively held in our own depths via the archetypes. When he talks about the collective unconscious, he's basically talking about the archetypal unconscious that is present in each of us, that is the accumulated patterning and numinous wisdom and also shadow complexes that inform our experience. Third, he reaching really deep in back into the world of his own childhood and his folk culture that he was born into the primal worldview of humanity, he extended his sense of the psyche into the natural world. You see this with all his work with synchronicities, but with the I Ching, with his attention to the movements of birds and the wind of the blowing the waves stronger on the side of the lake, as inside the consulting room in his house, he's talking to a patient, the emotional charge is getting more strongly constellated as the patient is undergoing whatever it is they're going through, and he's noticing the patterning of outside and inside. Things are in coherence. There's an archetypal coherence informing the inner and the outer. He's like a shaman, a Chinese sage who is seeing the larger pattern at work. And he ultimately is helping us recognize the anima mundi, the re-enchantment of the world as well as the psyche, as he sees the archetypes as informing matter and spirit, world and self. It's this point that Hillman picks up so powerfully in that great turning point that Hillman made in 1980 or so, 81, where he writes that great essay called Anima Mundi, The Return of the Soul to the World. You can get it now in a little book called The Thought of the Heart and the Soul of the World, two great essays from the early 80s. Hillman uses these words to describe this very dramatically. I think this has a lot to say about our moment in history. Ecology movements, futurism, feminism, urbanism, protest and disarmament, personal individuation, all these cannot alone save the world from the catastrophe inherent in our very idea of the world. All of these require a cosmological vision that saves the phenomenon world itself. They require a move in soul that goes beyond measures of expediency to the archetypal source of our world's continuing peril, which is the fateful neglect, the repression of the anima mundi. You can see that what modernity has done is it has compared to the primal worldview, where we live in a world in which everything in the earth is filled with psychic and spiritual presence, and the wind, the water, the trees, the animals and the birds, the movements of the stars, the cycles of the sun and the moon, all these are experienced as carrying meaning, carrying purposes. There is a communication that can happen between the human being and the rest of nature because they speak the same mythic language from the primal point of view. Joe Campbell described it. He'd often start his lectures. I remember he'd say things like, this one line, straight from the opening of The Hero with a Thousand Faces, he would repeat, "It would not be too much to say that myth is the secret opening through which the cosmos pours its inexhaustible energies into human cultural manifestation." That viewpoint that the cosmos is pouring through myth, through symbol, its own energies, its inexhaustible energies into human culture, into the human psyche. That is not a modern statement. A modern statement would be, it would not be too much to say that myth is the secret opening through which the unconscious psyche is projecting its craving for meaning onto the neutralized cosmos that has no intrinsic meaning in itself, but that we, in our desire for living in a meaningful universe, project out of essentially psychological need. This great move that modernity made to basically try to own its own subjective projections, which comes out of the scientific revolution, out of the Copernican revolution, which was like the ultimate owning of a projection, where we thought what we thought was moving out there was actually ourselves moving, right? Every night the stars seem to move across the sky, and the Copernican revolution makes us recognize, wait a minute, we're the ones that are moving. The earth is moving and all the stars seem to be moving. That act of reflexivity is the great cosmological seeing through that in many ways makes possible depth psychology, as Jung saw. He actually said, because the stars have fallen from the heavens, that's why we need and why we have depth psychology. Because prior to that, the stars carried the symbols. It carried the symbolic meaning. We lived in a symbolic culture. When the stars fell, we needed to discover those meanings in the depths of the psyche where it had descended into our own suppressed unconscious. But in Jung's later years, and of course he studied astrology very, very avidly, used it with all of his patients in his later years, we now know from his from family and friends. And of course, he used other divinatory methods as well, so much like the I Ching. He was living in an enchanted cosmos. But he also knew, and there's this intrinsic paradox in Jungian psychology, he also knew that it was the disenchantment of the universe that aided the modern self in starting to recognize its projections. And so then we're left with a paradox. Well, what's coming from us and what's really there? What's a projection of our need and what is maybe truly being carried symbolically by a meaningful universe? That's a very tricky issue, which I think in many ways many depth psychologists, Jungians included, are grappling with have not directly addressed. And I think we can get an insight into that by recognizing that what is required is to see that either looking at the cosmos as being radically disenchanted and absolutely meaningless and purposeless in itself, and only meaning and purpose comes from the human being. Okay, so that's one, that's the conventional modern worldview. That basically is an I-it relationship to the world, right? The I and the it, rather than an I-thou relationship. Now, but then what about the person who is projecting, let's put it into the human sphere, a person who projects the ideal divine beloved onto another person who they just have to be with. They're absolutely certain this is the person for them. The other person may not even know they exist, you know, as in like the stalker phenomenon with the movie star. Or it could, but it also could just be a person that one projects this perfection, this consummation of all that would be possible if I only were with this person. Maybe one even gets to be with that person, and then a month or a year or 20 years later, one wakes up and realizes what one was projecting onto that person. That too is an I-it relationship if you are using the other person as essentially a screen to project the unconscious archetypal complex onto them. So what's required in both cases, in romance as well as in romantic love as well as in engaging a potentially enchanted universe, an anima mundi, an ensouled world, what's required in both cases is the capacity for an I-thou relationship where one is not projecting one's needs but is listening to the other and giving it the possibility of carrying meaning but not necessarily requiring that meaning just because one needs it. That requires self-awareness. That requires self-discernment. It requires psychological, painful work to go inside and see what are one's needs, one's shadows, one's archetypal complexes that are driving my way of behaving and perceiving. Then I can see the other for who he is, for who she is, for who the ensouled world might be. And with that insight, we can start to see how what Hillman's talking about, how we need to, that the world cannot be saved just by all these, you know, invaluable social movements and personal individuation and so forth. It has to be saved by a whole transformation in how we regard the world, the anima mundi. And for that to happen, the modern human being has to undergo a radical overcoming of that great appropriation of all meaning and purpose in the universe that it did at the birth of the modern self. And to recognize that in this systematic effort to de-anthropomorphize our understanding, our cognition, and neutralize the cosmos, as the philosopher Charles Taylor put it, regard it as being, how did Taylor put it, disenchanting the cosmos, which is the term that Weber originally used. We could also call that, Charles Taylor says, neutralizing the cosmos, because the cosmos is no longer seen as the embodiment of a meaningful order which can define the good for us. We demystify the cosmos as a setter of ends by grasping it mechanistically and functionally as a domain of possible means. Then the utilitarian mindset can take over and basically see the world as an object for our self-enhancement rather than as a thou. And this tremendous act of objectification of the world empowers the subjectivity of the human self. The human modern self is tremendously empowered. Taylor puts it this way. He says, this is from that great book he wrote called The Sources of the Self. This differentiation between the subject of self and the object of world helped generate a new notion of individual independence and emancipation, because the disengaged subject is an independent being in the sense that his or her paradigm purposes are to be found within and not dictated by the larger order of which he or she is part. So what we, I think, now are in is this tremendous moment of recognizing and in a way, this is one of the great gifts of our postmodern era, which has seen through the modern stance to a great extent, that has helped us see how much the modern objectified view is one more lens, it's one more interpretation. It doesn't have a claim to a God's eye view. And that, in fact, one could say that this systematic effort to de-anthropomorphize the world and eliminate its even potentially carrying meaning and purposes beyond what are coming from the human, that may be, in the end, the most anthropocentric act of all, to appropriate all meaning in the whole universe and say it's really just the human being that is carrying that. How could the part be so much superior to the whole that would be true? But it's part of the modern spell, a tremendously empowering spell, to have lived within that highly convincing experience of the monotheistic, heroic, Cartesian solar ego, which objectifies the universe. And we've had to go through a death, a deconstruction of that self, a deconstruction of the whole modern project, of the inevitable success of progress, of Western civilization, of modernity, of human reason, bringing ever greater horizons and heights of human achievement vis-a-vis this nature which we can control and understand through science and technology. It's a tremendous solar inflation that has left out the other half of life. It's left out the whole in favor of the part. It's left out the lunar ground out of the solar in favor of this solar day. Even our nights in the city are dominated by the day consciousness. There's a beautiful movie called documentary called The City Dark that you might want to see sometime about what may be being lost by night after night. The fact that we don't see the stars in anywhere near like the vividness that we saw the stars for millennia. Some people have not seen the Milky Way, living in the great urban centers of Earth's human civilization. And what does that do when one experiences only the solar consciousness of the day, even at nighttime, the electrical light, which is, Heidegger put it, we mortals have turned, I'm paraphrasing, but this is close to what he said, turned night into day and day into a state of harassed unrest. But the world is deep, deeper than day can comprehend. And I think we can now begin to recognize, drawing on Jung's work, drawing on Campbell's work with his recognition of the hero's journey and the descent into the underworld, the night sea journey of the solar principle going at underneath into the depths, we can begin to see that perhaps the reason that we don't have adequate rites of passage, sacred initiatory rituals in our society, widespread, compared with every other society that ever existed, modern society is uniquely devoid of adequate containers for that profound initiatory transformation that allows the child to become an adolescent, to become a mature member of the tribe, that allows the incipient shaman to become a shaman, that allows the to go through what Jung himself went through in as depicted in the Red Book. Why don't we have those adequate rites of passage? I mean, you can see tremendous impulses in that direction, that wild energy of youth that needs that the danger. It needs to get to the edge. It needs to push the boundary, which is exactly what initiatory rites of passage require. We don't have those rites of passage, and so, of course, our civilization is run by adolescence in consciousness. Just turn on the TV for a moment or look at any trailer for an upcoming blockbuster, and you see how much it is run by an adolescent consciousness, because authentic maturity has not been supported by this larger, by the society that would permit going into the depths, contacting the great archetypal sources of meaning in life and death, and to be able to come back with that trust in the cosmos and that trust in life and that trust in the depths of psyche that allow us to engage life and the challenges of life with a new consciousness. And in the tribal societies, the archaic societies, to come back with that grounding that permits the society to spiritually and materially sustain itself in the future. And I would suggest that the reason that we don't have those rites of passage is not simply because we forgot, we've been ignorant of it, we became myopic with our materialist assumptions and so forth. And the lack of the rites of passage help to keep us from connecting to the spiritual depths, so it's a kind of self-reinforcing loop where we live in a disenchanted cosmos. So rites of passage of that sort wouldn't make sense. So then we're not initiated into being able to see the depths of meaning in the cosmos and in life. And so it keeps, everybody's living on the surface. In the meantime, with tremendously powerful technologies and a kind of one-sidedly solar consciousness that is tyrannically driving the planet into a catastrophic state. And I would submit that I would suggest that the reason we don't have those is because it seems as if we, as a civilization, as a species, are going through an initiatory rite of passage. In some sense, not having the societal and individual initiations creates all the more the pressure cooker of the collective going through everything that an initiation constellates. Namely, you separate the individual from the community, and you put that individual through, take it from the tribe, from the mothers, and you put them into isolation where they confront their mortality. they die to their old identity. There's a deconstruction of their very sense of selfhood. There is a crisis of meaning, of metaphysical meaning. There is a suffering. There's a loss. There is tremendous sense of uncertainty. And all of these are crucial for that transformation. But in the case of modern civilization, it isn't the individual separated from the tribal community. It's Homo sapiens itself has been separated from the larger community of being itself, the entire anima mundi, the ensouled cosmos, has been occluded from our vision. We've just become a humanist project, isolated from the larger cosmic drama that we are, in fact, intrinsically part of and an expression of. And since we are ultimately the cosmos in human form, we too must be part of the cosmic unfolding. Even our myopia, even our crisis of meaning, our deconstruction of our old identity, our encounter with mortality that is now happening on a planetary scale, in all these ways, it would seem almost as if the universe is constellating a partner for an I-thou relationship. It is a very painstaking evolution has taken place over thousands of years, accelerating with greater and greater intensity and speed as we get closer to our own moment, till we're almost like reaching this kind of perinatal climax. And it would seem that the universe has kind of painstakingly differentiated a form of itself, you know, from early primate, mammalian, tetrapod evolution all the way up to Homo sapiens, and then the particular form of Homo sapiens that the modern consciousness represents. And that this is itself a drama that is part of a larger cosmic unfolding that is in some ways depending on us for its continued unfolding. And our sense of uncertainty is crucial to the potential success of this initiatory experiment. And we all have a ground of understanding in some ways deep in our own bodies and deep in our own psyches, because we are all born. We all lost the womb. We all were separated from the womb of being in our own births. We've all been through an extraordinary drama, an epic loss, a tragic loss at the moment it's happening. And yet that loss, that tragedy, that differentiation out of the ground of being, and all the incredible, you know, contraction into material separation, it was crucial for us to become born, to be a new being. And that seems to me to be an analogy, a metaphor, perhaps the very biological expression of this same larger archetypal pattern that we may be in our moment living through. H.G. Wells said once, we're in a race between education and catastrophe. I would just slightly rephrase it, that we're in a race between initiation and catastrophe. And the more people who can undergo this within themselves, and the more we can hold this powerful process for each other, and this is why we need communities that hold this larger vision and this capacity to, in some sense, trust such a powerful death-rebirth process in our own lives, in the lives of our communities, and then ultimately in the life of the Earth community, that will potentially play a very, very helpful role as we go through what are bound to be some pretty dramatic upcoming decades that we here in this room and our children and our grandchildren are very likely to encounter. I love that phrase from Nietzsche where he said, when he's summing up the ancient Greek mysteries, he could have used the same phrase to sum up Christianity too in its deepest, in its depths. He said, all pain is birth pain. That's an incredible insight. All pain is birth pain. It takes everything, every loss, every suffering, every tragedy, and places it in the service of a larger evolutionary unfolding that doesn't wipe out the, it doesn't negate the suffering, it doesn't negate the loss. It rather encompasses the loss in such a way that a larger good, a larger whole, an unexpected birth can come out of that death. And I think that mystery is what depth can provide us. The depth psychology in many ways is all about that, a kind of a sacrament, a kind of sacred ritual that Jung himself went through, and that so many of us in our time are going through. And I think we, if we can see ourselves as part of this larger unfolding that is using us as vessels for its unfolding, and using the particularities of our own struggle for its unfolding, that allows our suffering, our loss, our grief to be in service of something of a larger purpose, a larger meaning. All of creation groaneth in travail for the birth of this, whatever it is that is seeking be born through the present into the future. Okay, so those are a few thoughts. Let me now open it up to your comments and thoughts and reflections and questions. Does anybody have anything they'd like to contribute? Please.
You mentioned, you've spoken about the soul and the lunar and also masculine and
feminine. Yes. Teich, mm-hmm. Yeah, Howard Teich, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a very intriguing metaphor, the solar feminine, the lunar feminine, the solar and lunar masculine, this idea of the solar and the masculine being decoupled, and the lunar and the feminine being decoupled, complexifying masculine and complexifying feminine. And I guess my question is, in terms of the metaphorical richness, does it really is it more than like anima and animus theory in disguise? Does the metaphor offer us access to something new, or is it just pouring old wine into new casks?
Yeah, I think I'm so glad you brought this up. I mean, when I do more than an hour and a half talk, and sometimes even in an hour and a half talk, I will often engage this because I deeply feel that the kind of reduction of solar to masculine and lunar to feminine or vice versa is in some sense continuing a patriarchal bias, and as a number of feminist Jungians have very, I think, rightly critique the animus theory, for example. I love the controversial essay by Lynn Cowan called Dismantling the Animus. When I lectured in Minnesota to the Jungians there, she lives there. I remember she came up to me afterwards and said, you know, the name of my talk there was Understanding Our Moment in History. And she said, you know, in some ways, that is the only topic today there is, in some ways, you know, understanding our moment in history. For the benefit of others who don't know this, for many years I'd been in my circle of colleagues, students, women and men, have striven to kind of understand this challenging problem. See, on the one hand, Jung made such a great gift of the recognizing, first of all, the dignity of the feminine vis-a-vis the masculine, even to the point of saying, like, the answer to Job in his essay, Answer to Job, and what can save us from apocalypse is basically the ascent of the feminine into full parity with the masculine, which he sees as already taking place in the collective psyche. And his recognition that inside every man is a feminine dimension of the psyche that is crucial for his wholeness, and in every woman is a masculine side that is unconscious and needs to be integrated, etc. These are huge advances, but there's also real problems. If you assign rationality to the masculine, if you assign consciousness to the masculine, the solar, and see these as one, which is typical in not just Western and esoteric contexts, but also in yin-yang, as feminine and masculine, soul and luna, it reifies certain gender biases that are part of patriarchal socialization. And it comes up a number of times in Jung's own writings, where he'll just say things about women and women's psychology, or men and the anima, that are clearly reflecting a patriarchal prejudice and are embarrassing to read today. And the problem becomes particularly acute because it's very hard to speak about the feminine without thinking about women and women's psychology. And you see it very in a wonderful person like, say, Marion Woodman. I think Lynn Cowan pointed this out, where Marion will be talking about the feminine as existing in both men and women. Both are psyches, which is the typical Jungian understanding that feminine's in both sides of us. And so don't get caught in, we're just talking about feminine in both sides of us and masculine in both sides of it. But then in a subsequent sentence or paragraph, she'll be talking about the feminine as women and women's psychology. And she won't have noticed that she's just moved from one meaning to the other. It's impossible not to do that. Howard Teich, I just had dinner with him the other day. He, many years ago, he's not particularly a Jungian. I think he was seeing a Jungian. He's a therapist, psychotherapist. But he was, in his own journey, was noticing that it was difficult for him to work with what was called the feminine side of his own being when he saw it as, in some sense, part of his own masculinity that he hadn't adequately developed. And this is something I think many women can recognize if we say that the only way you can really be an individual who is capable of assertive self-determination, of individuality, of the personal assertion of the will and of rationality is for you to cultivate your inner man. That's straight out of the classical Jungian textbooks. To do that impoverishes the fullness of what it is to be a woman, and vice versa. for a man. And there is a solution at hand, which is, in a way, astrology has always carried this idea that we all are born with the sun and the moon in the sky when we're born. And the sun and the moon are these great archetypal principles, and they are not. It could be liberating for us to recognize that there is a not just a lunar feminine, but also a solar feminine, so that like a woman who is being self-determining individual, a Hillary Clinton who is very much capable of executive egoic leadership and assertion of will and intellect as a public figure outside of the home, the private, the familial, the emotional, intuitive, somatic dimensions that are assigned to the feminine and the lunar. That she can be seen as, in that respect, a solar feminine individual. At the same time, the lunar feminine would be the part of a woman who is capable to be, of being a mother, of being nurturing, of being relational and in touch with her feelings and her body. A man who is holding his infant child with infinite tenderness is not just cultivating his feminine side. It's a part of his masculinity that is real, that has been in some sense suppressed by patriarchy. That's why it's so important for, I think, men to be at the births of their children or to be, you know, playing a huge role in the very early part of their children's lives, because that's a part of themselves. What we could call their lunar masculine self can be owned, can be recovered, and can be developed. And then that helps us with that tremendous problem of differentiating what's masculine and what's feminine, and assigning these kind of virtues and vices to one or the other. That being said, it gets more complex, though, because it's clear that women have a certain special relationship to the what we could call the lunar archetypal dimension of being or way of being. Women's spirituality program at CIS carries that. Women's ways of knowing. The fact, as many psychologists have pointed out, that women's the nature of the female body, from whether it's the corpus callosum in the brain structure or the permeability of the female body as expressed in menstruation, in sexual intercourse, in conception, in giving birth, in nursing, in all these ways, that permeable body in which one can become two is that shapes the female ego and egoic psychological development in crucial ways that are different than a male body. In addition, testosterone plays a role. It shapes. I mean, there's all sorts of hormonal factors that play a role in our connection to lunar and solar, but by reifying it that females are just this way and males are just that way is a tremendous limitation and impoverishment. And if we can recognize that in many ways, I think our time is a time in which women's owning of their autonomy, I'm being tremendously generalizing, but women's owning of their autonomy and men's capacity to recover their capacity for relationality and for being in touch with their, you know, their feelings, their vulnerability, etc. These are absolutely crucial elements in whatever initiatory transformation our society is going through. And this also helps us with the fact that when we use masculine and feminine as terms, you can have quotation marks around them. Sometimes we do this in our writing. Well, you're being very masculine. Okay, but we put it quotes. That's not a very feminine way of being. Well, there's feminine as a local cultural construct of what it is to be feminine. And that gets the great danger of archetypal and Jungian perspectives that get into this area is that they can reify the cultural construct of what it is to be feminine with the feminine. But we know from studying all the goddesses of world mythologies, there's many ways of being feminine. Same thing as there's Aphrodite, but there's Kali. There's the Virgin Mary, there's Pele, there's Shakti, there's Hera, there's the Medusa. There's many, many ways of embodying the feminine, and same thing with the masculine. Yes, there's Hercules, Prometheus, Zeus, but there's Orpheus, there's Krishna, there's Dionysus. There's many different ways of being masculine. So that liberates it's very difficult for a man to hear that that certain virtues are feminine virtues alone. And it's very difficult, I think, for women to hear that, well, the masculine capacity to be whatever, assertive, independent, rational. There's huge problems that go with that. And it comes from conflating the cultural local version of masculine and feminine with some archetypal masculine and feminine and giving it a timeless, eternal dimension. Okay, one last thing. Yes, we all have masculine, we all have solar and lunar in us. And I think this is emerging more and more. I mean, in my own life, I'm one of six boys in my family, the eldest of eight children, six boys, two girls. And every one of the boys, not because we're copying each other or anything like that, we were living in totally different parts of the country and had totally different circumstances, but everyone has either been the main child care parent of the children's early life, or the sole one in a couple of cases, up to 50%, like exactly half and half. Not out of like some sacrificial, act or something. It was like it just came natural. And that's happening more and more. You look at the Scandinavian countries, social policies are starting to change that can encourage that through childcare, paternity leave, et cetera. So this shift is starting to take place. That being said, I want to also recognize that there is a way in which not only our solar and lunar inside each of us as men and women, there's also a way in which there is a feminine side of every man. I'm not saying lunar right now. I'm saying a feminine side of every man, and there is a masculine side of every woman. And this comes from, you can see it, for example, first of all, many times in non-ordinary states of consciousness, such as deep initiatory experiences, ayahuasca journey, or a spiritual emergency, active imagination. One can have a man can have an experience of what it is to be a woman, and a woman can have an experience of what it is to be a man. Physically, they somatically can. It could be sometimes they experience it as if it was another lifetime, like a karmic experience that's in the unconscious. Sometimes they can have an experience that's familial or ancestral, like, for example, I've had the experience of in one LSD session back in my 20s, where I very vividly became my mother giving birth to myself, experienced the pregnancy, could, you know, like how the body feels, how you have to hold yourself, all the somatic sensations, the emotional sensations, felt the great mother archetype coming into me very vividly, one of the most numinous experiences I've ever had. This happens a lot. People who do holotropic breath work or whatever work with people who regularly, men and women, have experiences of a contrasexual nature that could be karmic, could be could be archetypal. And you even, and of course, you, this becomes vividly apparent in a person who feels that, who goes through a transsexual transition, a transformation, transgender. It's a huge phenomenon. It's just as gay rights and gay lesbian emancipation and gay and lesbian marriage is such a huge issue right now. That's a sign of this whole sacred marriage emerging in the collective psyche, and a redefining and a liberating of male and female, masculine and feminine, and solar and lunar. But the people who are transsexuals, boy, they're carrying that in a very vivid way, and I come from San Francisco. You can walk down the street in the Castro district, and there'll be men who are walking down the street, perhaps dressed just like a woman. They identify, they want to be called she, and they experience themselves. They're like they're a queen, literally. That's the term of choice. And they're examples of a solar feminine in a male body, okay? And the same thing, does everybody get? Like, I mean, they're not defining themselves like that they want to be a mother or something. They're a solar feminine queen in a male body. And then others feel so strongly that they identify with the female body that they will change their male body into female, or vice versa, take testosterone and so forth. So each human person is a microcosm of the whole of the cosmos, and all the archetypal possibilities are there, solar and lunar, masculine and feminine, and each of us is carrying that potential. And if we can liberate ourselves and each other to find those journeys into the particular embodiment and incarnation of the solar, lunar, masculine, feminine, it's going to be a much happier world and a much more profoundly integrated and balanced world and saner world. I know I've touched on a lot of, you brought up, I think, a very important issue, and I'd been talking about solar and lunar all through tonight, and I'd also made reference to patriarchy and to the fact that it's been a patrilineal tradition that in many ways constellated the global crisis. The Western mind, the modern mind, has been dominated by men. And a solar masculine dominance. And the problem isn't simply masculine versus feminine as identical to solar versus lunar. It's that the solar masculine has dominated and negated, suppressed, and devalued the solar feminine, which is what a lot of women's liberation is about. It's negated and devalued the lunar feminine as being like, well, your place is just in the home, but that's not as important as the public life of what we men are doing, or even what you women who go out and become Margaret Thatcher or whatever. That's important, but it's not as important as giving birth or having children and nourishing other human beings, and etc. That kind of devaluing. And also, the solar masculine has negated and suppressed the lunar masculine, so that men have been impoverished by this tremendous one-sidedness. So the ending of Passion of the Western Mind, which I wrote 20 years ago, where I talked about the great drama of the masculine and feminine and how the masculine has differentiated itself out of the feminine ground of being and is now in the crisis of that dissociation, and everything depends on the overcoming of that dissociation and the elevation of the feminine to its proper dignity and the sacred marriage occurring. I would amend that because while I was talking about the masculine and feminine in both men and women in the classical Jungian way, I hadn't yet seen through to the recognition of how much we can't talk about masculine and feminine without thinking about men and women, embodied men and women. And it's really, if I were rewriting it, it's the solar masculine in relationship to an antagonism with the solar feminine, and lunar masculine. If you can carry that kind of archetypal complexity, and I'm giving you lots of nuances here, but you're all getting it, I can see. And that's, I think that helps liberate our language. Language is so important, and it allows us as men or as women to have a greater freedom in becoming who we uniquely are. It helps the individuation process, and it also, I think, is going to help us get out of some of the unnecessary stereotypical battle of the sexes that can happen when you assign certain values and virtues to one gender versus the other. Sometimes one gender's virtues are given the moral ascendancy, and the others are seen as inferior. It used to be that the masculine was the superior and the feminine was inferior in places like Seattle and San Francisco. Suddenly to be masculine is not a very, that's not a big compliment to say you're being very masculine. But if being masculine can start to carry that greater complexity, and we being feminine can also carry greater complexity, and we can recognize that there's solar and lunar in all of us, there's also masculine and feminine in all of us in a different way, much more often deep and unconscious, I think we have a greater ground. It's a more nuanced and complex honoring of the nuanced complexity of what it is to be a human person. Okay, please.
I really hope you'll go back to your book and add to it and do it, because it sounds like it's time for innovation. Yes, please do. And also a question for you.
Please.
And that is, given the fact that we're at this fascinating point, and it's also a very difficult point, because there's been so much polarization and everything's been turned into sound bites, I don't see as much active and open listening going on in the world as we need to facilitate this great kind of opening and acceptance that we, all of us, everybody in the world needs to do in order to let this to come into a great sort of eye-to-eye relationship. Let's hope that happens. But I'm seeing the world in a slightly dire fashion, unfortunately. And I wish you had more time to talk about this incredibly fascinating concept of yours. I guess I want to ask, A, do you see it in a less dire manner? And B, is there any hope for most of the world's consciousness backing off the soundbitey, polarizing, judgmental? How are we going to bring this on? How on earth?
Well, we're certainly not going to pull it off by some, just sheer act of, gumption and human brilliance. And yet the world probably and our future probably does depend on our bringing all of our determination and courage and imagination and mind, soul, and body to the task. At the same time, I have some trust or faith in also larger forces at work than we can see. And that comes, that trust, at least in my own case, has come painfully, through experiences of having to be pretty certain that what has happened is so tragic, a loss, that nothing can redeem this. And then with the passage of time and the transformation of my own consciousness, recognizing that that was a crucial part of a larger process. Yes, great. Two things. One, there's a beautiful song in the Grateful Dead's album called American Beauty, which is probably the most spiritually beautiful flowering of the late 60s, early 70s counterculture as in a particular album, American Beauty, with the songs like In the Attics of My Life or Ripple, Box of Rain. And trucking, sometimes light's just shining on me and other times I can barely see. But in this one song where they sing, when I had no wings to fly, you flew to me. They're addressing the divine. When I had no song to sing, you sang to me. That captures the moment of the kenosis, the my God, why hast thou forsaken me? It's right at that moment that the divine is emptying itself into the human condition. And then the alchemical transformation takes place. And in a deep initiatory experience, there is simultaneously a sense of encountering what seems to encountering death. It's a death of one's being, one's identity, an ego death, but it even can have a very powerful somatic quality. If you've seen people go through or experienced it yourself, a full-on perinatal crisis, it looks like the person's dying, or you feel like you're dying. You can't breathe. Everything's coming to an end. It's a crisis of life and death intensity, and that's precisely the crucible in which the greatest psycho-spiritual transformations take place. And near-death experiences are precisely the most powerful experiences for reconfiguring moral values. I don't know anybody who hasn't had some form of a near-death experience, whether it was through a experiencing a terminal illness or an accident or some form of near-death experience that didn't come back profoundly changed with a whole different sense of life. I mean, Jung himself did from the 1944 on. And you cannot have a pretend near-death experience. It has to be totally like you're thinking this is for sure going to happen. And I think it's necessary somehow for our civilization to undergo what it's about to undergo. And what we can perhaps best hope for is that it will be a surgical strike that will allow enough of an encounter with planetary mortality registering on enough crucial people that deep changes are made in our social, political, economic, gender relations, and perhaps above all, ecological, cosmological stance and relational mode of being, that we transform our civilization and transform ourselves in relationship to the whole. And I think that is the best outcome, which I have hope for, which is different than a rational optimism based on just the facts. It's more of an attitude of faith and hope. And on that note, I'll thank you very much for your being with me tonight. Thank you very much.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.